New York Times bestselling author Mark Kurlansky has written The Food of a Younger Land, a portrait of American food before the national highway system, before chain restaurants, and before frozen food, when the nation's food was seasonal, regional, and traditional from the lost WPA files. Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, has the review and begins by reading from the book.
From the introduction. When someone says to me, I went to Chicago last week, or I went down to Virginia this summer, a question always comes into my mind, though I often resist asking it. What did you eat? Anything interesting? I would like to know what politicians eat on the campaign trail, what Picasso ate in his pink period, what Walt Whitman ate while writing the verse that defined America, what Midwesterners bring to potlucks, what is served at company banquets, what is in Sunday dinner these days, and what workers bring for lunch. What people eat is not well documented. Food writers prefer to focus on fashionable, expensive restaurants whose creative dishes reflect little of what most people are eating. We know everything about Paris restaurants, but nothing about what Parisians eat. We know little about what Americans eat and less about what they ate. To see that pre-war America was a very different country, one has only to contemplate the origin of this book. To anyone who knows and understands the United States, the fact that there was a federal writers' project at all in the 1930s seems nothing short of miraculous. This is America, the land with no Ministry of Culture, where politicians alone are portrayed on the money. Almost unique among Western republics, the likeness of not one writer, philosopher, painter, or composer has ever graced the engraving of a U.S. coin or bill. The separation of church and state may be the great articulated legal principle, but another sacrosanct concept is the separation of state and culture. And yet there was an age when the U.S. government permanently employed painters, sculptors, playwrights, musicians, actors, and writers to produce art. And so opens The Food of a Younger Land, a portrait of American food before the national highway system, before chain restaurants, and before frozen food, when the nation's food was seasonal, regional, and traditional, from the lost WPA, Works Progress Administration, files. Americans love to eat. And over the past few years, it's become clear to anyone keeping up with the bestsellers lists that Americans have come to love reading about food and eating. And it's no surprise that my favorite travel guides for going anywhere in the U.S. of A. are those old 1930, 1940 Works Progress Administration travel guides, or WPA travel guides. The breadth and depth of small town as well as big city America is spread across those pages, written as an antidote to the Great Depression years. Imagine my surprise then when I discovered that this same program, the WPA, had engaged some of America's finest writers and journalists to produce a geographic and historical guide to the food ways, the many different cuisines, of Depression-era America. Well, I'm there. But wait, how fun a read, how interesting a read can a book about old cuisines be? I was quite skeptical within a few pages of beginning The Food of a Younger Land. But as I read through, moving in this case from Kansas to Nebraska to Vermont, you can follow the nation geographically, or you can do what I do and kind of skip around as you're consuming this book. My attitude changed. And I'm now happy to say that I'm a fan of The Food of a Younger Land. This truly was a younger land. As the subtitle stated, before the U.S. highways of the post-war 1950s, before the colonization of our highways and even our byways by the national chains, perhaps in the 1930s and 40s, you might find a Howard Johnson here and there. And before superstores and before microwave cooking changed the way Americans shop and eat. These are stories of an America still enraptured by its immigrant roots, from the coast of New England through the vast rolling plains of the Midwest and on from sea, literally, to shining sea. Food of a Younger Nation is both a snapshot in time of the foodways of Americans circa 1940, but it is also a catch-all of snapshots of American foodways from the late 19th century into the then modern day, as folks interviewed and written about remember how and what folks ate in the times of their memory. And so we do indeed go back to the late 19th century, since this book was composed in just about 1940-41. We learn about the May breakfasts of Vermont, The Automats of New York City, which our author from 1940 describes as, here in the Automat, the man in a hurry is worried by no middlemen. His relationship with his fodder, over which he may gloat, ruminate, or despair, is strictly private. He selects, pays, conveys, eats, and departs, leaving no tip, uttering no sound. 250,000 New Yorkers go through these silent processes daily in favored or convenient automats. Some are regular customers, others appear only on certain days, keeping a tryst with a favorite dish. No New York wife knows her husband until she has studied him in an automat. And all suburban mothers have learned that on a day in town, lunch at the automat is the kid's delight. We learn about Montana fried beaver tail. And yes, that's just what you're thinking it is. We read about a Los Angeles sandwich called a taco, in which 1940s readers would not only discover the taco, but also the tortilla, the chalupa, and the French-dipped sandwich. And we visit the threshing dinners of the Great Plains states. Listen to this marvelous telling of the feasts that were prepared and consumed with gusto by the men and the women who traveled from farm to farm, harvesting the fall crops of corn and grain across the great prairies of an earlier America. The huge threshing machine with its coat of bright red paint chugging down the road behind the puffing steam engine was a thrilling sight to one little girl on a Gage County, Nebraska farm in the late 90s. With keen interest, she watched it turn into her father's grain field. By this time, the men of the neighborhood were arriving. Some came with hay racks and pitchforks, others with lumber wagons and shovels. Even the horses seemed to sense the excitement as they pricked up their ears and pulled at their reins. Eagerly, the little girl listened for the blast of the shrill whistle and the hum of machinery which announced that at last the long-anticipated day was here. On this red-letter day, the little girl must help her mother cook for the threshers. She felt happy anticipation, getting ready for them, like dressing for a party. At last they were really coming. The cream was churned up and down with a dasher until the little balls of butter appeared. Potatoes were dug from the patch in the garden. A big bucket of beets was pulled from the patch. With eager anticipation, the little girl looked forward to the trip in the spring wagon to the nearest town for a roast of beef. Mother had the pies in the oven very early in the morning on the day when the threshers came. There were always plenty of them, at least half a dozen. Mince, apple, peach, cherry, raisin, and custard were favorites. To work alone with mother getting ready for the threshers made one feel important and necessary. But when the threshers came, it was nice to have two grown-up ladies dressed in crisp calico dresses and aprons in the kitchen helping mother. It was such fun to go with mother when she helped the neighbor in return, especially if there was a little girl one's own age to play with. It was also much nicer to have a little playmate along when one went to the garden for the vegetables. By 11:30, all was hustle and bustle. Time was moving fast. Soon the whistle would blow for dinner. There was a blast from the whistle. The machine stopped, and the men, hungry and dirty, hurried to the house. There were always at least 20 of them, so many that some had to wait for the second table. How the hungry men stored away the food. It was all on the table. Meat, vegetables, pickles, preserves, gravy, cups of steaming hot coffee, pitchers of thick cream. Calories were unheard of back in the 1890s. Everything that the farm afforded was prepared in large quantities. Now, meaning the 1940s, many of the farm women have become calorie conscious and they plan balanced meals. They are not so dependent upon the home-prepared foods as they once were. The trend today, in the 1940s, is towards serving a single dessert instead of several kinds of cake and pie. Fruit salad, fresh fruit, or ice cream are quite frequently served now. And some women are beginning to serve cafeteria style, and in a few cases, paper plates are being used. In the 1930s and into the early 40s, the Works Progress Administration was charged with finding work for millions of unemployed Americans. It sought work in every imaginable field. For unemployed writers, the WPA created the Federal Writers Project, which was charged with conceiving books, assigning them to huge, unwieldy teams of out-of-work and want-to-be writers around the country, and editing and publishing them. After producing hundreds of guidebooks on America in a few hurried years, a series that met with greater success than anyone had imagined possible for such a government project, the Federal Writers Project administrators were faced with the daunting challenge of coming up with projects to follow their first achievements. The writer-turned-administrator who first conceived the idea for these guidebooks came up with the thought of a book about the varied food and eating traditions throughout America, an examination of what and how Americans ate. When I opened the files years later of America Eats in the U.S. Library of Congress, I felt as though I had accidentally stumbled back into pre-war America. The manuscripts were all typed. Most of them were blurry duplicates, reproduced with carbon paper on that thin, translucent paper that they used to call onion skin. The America Eats project often took articles from magazines or newspapers or earlier WPA publications and put them in their files with the intention of using them in the new book. These, too, were typed. Within these gray cardboard boxes, it was pre-war America again. And I agree with other reviewers that, to his credit, Arthur Mark Kurlansky gives the original text of these food essays as he found them in those Library of Congress storage boxes, with all the natural beauty and all the odd phrasings that were part and parcel of writing in the late 30s, early 1940s. Please note The Food of a Younger Land is not a narrative history of American foodways, as some reviewers of this book seem to have expected. What it is a compilation of the best of articles, essays, poems, and not a few recipes, as selected by our author from those books, from the project that never quite made it to the press, that project named America Eats. Surprisingly, and happily, Food from a Younger Nation takes a serious look at foodways from before the Columbian explosion as well, taking us back well before the European immigration into the Americas. The accuracy may be suspect on some of these articles and essays, but the glimpses into the many different ways Native Americans grew, harvested, prepared, and ate foods before the arrival of Europeans and Africans is fascinating nonetheless, and it's about time we took this part of the nation's food history seriously. As our author notes, there are significant geographic omissions in the original concept of America Eats. Omissions, he says, are the result of the project being shut down before its completion. World War II, remember, erupted for America in 1941 with the bombing of Pearl Harbor, well before the final edition of America Eats was to be published. But what we do have here is a richly textured, quietly moving remembrance and celebration of America as it used to be, the food of a younger land indeed. And just in case you're interested in what Indiana was going to provide to America Eats, there's an interesting recipe in here from Hazel M. Nixon, from North Galveston Street in Indianapolis, Indiana, telling us how to make Indiana pork cake. And just a little bit later, Indiana persimmon pudding, complete with a recipe from a fellow who lives in Bloomington, Indiana. It's a wonderful look at America before the highway system, before McDonald's, before the national chains have kind of taken over how we eat. The Food of a Younger Land, a Portrait of American Food, from the Lost Works Progress Administration, WPA files, by Mark Kurlansky. It's available at a lot of our fine local public libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.
That was Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library. He's reviewed Mark Kurlansky's The Food of a Younger Land, a Portrait of American Food, published by Riverhead Books.